I'm having a midlife crisis. Now, what does that have to do with High Holy Days? Well, when you're having a midlife crisis, every day is like Yom Kippur. Because midlife is the time when you realize that you're actually going to die. And half of your life, at least half of it, is over. And you may not have accomplished everything that you've set out to accomplish. And worse, you may not have become the person you thought you were going to become. So it's time to kind of step back and evaluate. What is your life's purpose? And how are you doing with it? Midlife is kind of like an extended wake-up call to the soul. Now, at the same time, in midlife, you see, and this is the ugly part, you see that the things that got you through so far, your assets like beauty, brains, health, vigor, memory, all those things are fading. You can almost see them walking out the door every day, and you know they're not coming back. So midlife is the time that you have to look inside at your inner resources and take stock, like High Holy Days, right? This is what we do every year when we hear the sound of the shofar. Well, for me, it just so happens that I've convinced myself at midlife that I have to write a book. This book happens to be about my grandmother and my experience of caring for her before her death. That's not what matters. What matters is that I have decided that I must do this and I have a limited time left. So every morning, when I wake up, I hear a metaphoric clock ticking away the seconds of my life. And at the same time, in another corner of my brain, I hear my assets, my gifts, the things that I might need for this project, such as brains or creativity, slowly draining away as the clock ticks, ticks, ticks. Well, needless to say, it's not going well. It's hard to be creative when you're living at the bottom of a pressure cooker. Every year, I prepare myself for High Holy Days by finding the right story to tell. And this particular year, I was looking for a story, and I thought about a tape that a rabbi friend of mine from Israel had sent me, and I thought I might find a story on it. I turned on the tape, and I did find a story. But first, I heard some words of wisdom. My friend said, "When Moses stood at the burning bush, he asked God, 'What is your name?' And the answer was, 'Ehyeh asher ehyeh.' I am what I am." That's how it's usually translated. But my friend said that the more accurate translation is actually, "I will be what I will be." In other words, the God who delivers us out of slavery, from bondage into freedom, is the God of process. The God that's known as, "I will be what I will be." And if we can get in touch with that God within ourselves, then we're engaged in the process of becoming those things that are most important to us. And maybe, this is the best part, maybe in the end what we're judged for is not how much we've accomplished, but how much we've tried. How deeply we've been involved in the process of becoming what we're becoming. Well, this was very comforting to me, because my ratio of process to output has been rather high these days. And what followed was a story that was even more comforting. This was a story that was told to my friend when he was a young student, a yeshiva bacha. And it was told to him by the head of the school, the Rosh Yeshiva. Once, there was a Jew, a Hasidic Jew, who loved to pray. Well, you might say, all Hasidic Jews love to pray, that's what they do. But this Jew really loved to pray. He'd put on his tallis, he'd put on his tefillin, and he'd become so involved in the process of prayer that he felt he was one with the divine. Prayer to him was like ecstasy. He would pray and he would sway. He would savor the prayer and linger over each part of each prayer. Well, he couldn't pray in a synagogue because he prayed so slowly and so ecstatically that he was far behind the rest of the congregation in his own state of prayer. So, he'd pray at home. He'd get up very early, 4 or 5 in the morning, and he'd get ready. And he'd begin to pray as early as possible, and soon he'd become so lost in prayer that he'd cleave to God with his very being, and he'd pray, and he'd sway, and he'd daven, and time would pass. He'd often pray about 4 or 5 hours. When he was done, it'd be noon. Now, as you can imagine, he was not a wealthy man. He was so busy praying. But he managed to get by. He had a wife and a family, and a little farm that he rented from a non-Jewish landlord. Sometimes he would get behind on his rent, but his landlord didn't mind, and eventually he would manage to eke out a living between his prayers. One day, he came home, and he found a message, a notice from his landlord. And it said, "You are 5 months behind in your rent. I've warned you repeatedly. You haven't heeded my warnings. You must bring the total amount that you owe to my house 9 o'clock tomorrow, or you're out in the streets. Not 9:15, 9 o'clock. I don't care that it's winter. I don't care that you have a wife. You will be out on the streets if you're not here by 9 o'clock. I'm tired of you, Jew, taking advantage of me 9 o'clock sharp or else." Well, you'd think that the Jew would be worried, but actually, he wasn't. It just so happened that a few days before, he'd had a visit from a stranger, a man who had owed his father money. Now, his father had died some years past, but this stranger came and repaid the debt to him, so he had enough money to pay his rent and then some. So he wasn't worried at all. The only thing he was worried about was that 9 in the morning deadline. It was too late to bring the money in the evening, so he'd have to wait till the next morning, and he would have to say his prayers first. So he got himself up a few hours early the next morning. He was determined that he would keep a part of his mind on the clock. And he began to pray, and he began to sway, and he began to become immersed in the prayer, but he kept about a quarter of his mind focused on the time. And he kept praying, and he knew he'd have to speed things up a little bit. He kept thinking about the time, but then he began to get more and more ecstatic, and he became so joyous in his prayer that it felt like water washing over him and cleansing every part of his being. And he prayed and he swayed and he davened, and by the time he was finished, it was 11 o'clock. Well, when the Jew looked at the clock, he panicked. He said, "What can I do? It's too late. Oh, I might as well try. I'll go and I'll beg for his forgiveness. I don't have anything to lose." And so he raced to his landlord's house. He had the money with him, and by the time that he got there, it was almost noon. He was trembling as he rehearsed in his mind how he would beg for forgiveness, and he ran up to the gate to his landlord's house, and as he opened the gate, he saw the landlord coming out, running, racing towards him. Well, the Jew cowered and even shielded his head in case there were any blows as the landlord got closer. And the Jew cried out, "Please, please forgive me. I do have the money, and I beg you for your mercy. Please don't throw me in the streets." The landlord ran up to him and threw his arms around the Jew. And the Jew said, I'm so sorry. It'll never happen again. I promise I won't do it again. I have all of the money." The landlord embraced him, and he said, "You don't have to pay me a thing." "I don't understand." "I'll explain." And the landlord took him in the house and sat him down. "You see, I'm a wealthy man, a very wealthy man, and I don't have to do much work. So a lot of times I sit around with the other wealthy landowners, and we play cards, and we talk, and we make bets on the cards, and if we get really bored, we make side bets. We bet on all kinds of things just to pass the time. And I bet a friend of mine that a good Jew wouldn't miss a good davening, a good prayer session, for all the money in the world, no matter what was at stake." And so, we concocted a scheme to send you the notice, to give you a deadline. And when you showed up 3 hours late, you proved me right. I won the bet. And you made me an even wealthier man than I already am. After the story was told, the Rosh Yeshiva would look at his students with a twinkle in his eye, and he'd say, "So, what do we learn from this story? We never know what the bet is about. We never know what the bet is about." Well, when I heard that, I felt a little better about my midlife crunch. Suddenly, I got it. Maybe I don't really know what the bet is about for me. Maybe the project I've been so intent on isn't really what's important for me. Maybe what's important is sorting through the family stories to write the book. Maybe it's the process of learning some discipline to balance my creativity in my writing. Maybe that's what the bet is about for me. Maybe even it's all the distractions that keep me from my work. Maybe it's my work in the schools, my work with the synagogue, being the mother of two teenagers. Maybe all those things are really what I'm supposed to be focused on. I don't really know what the bet is about for me. Maybe the point is that I'm engaged in the process of becoming what I'm becoming. So, I bless us all this year as we listen to the sound of the shofar, as we search our souls that we get so lost in prayer, that we cleave to the divine, and we each get a little closer to knowing what the bet is about for each of us. And maybe we can all align ourselves a little closer to our true neshama, to our soul, in the process.